Hello, everyone. I'm Jackson Kahn, your host of the Ask AI podcast. We're very happy to be starting our second series of the Ask AI podcast. Thanks for all for joining us this summer. To all of our listeners and to interviewees and volunteers who made up the first series, it was so interesting and informative. We heard from leading Canadian startups, public policy influencers, and some of the other movers and shakers who are helping to shape the future of AI in Canada and beyond. If you haven't checked out the first set of 10 episodes, please do so. You can find them on Apple iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and more. Now, for our second series of the podcast, we'll be continuing our exploration of the Canadian artificial intelligence sector. We'll be talking with its top thought leaders, hearing from its innovators, and exploring its many issues and faucets, including in domains of ethics, policy, and more. But first, to kick off with a few community announcements. Thank you to Heather Evans. Listeners from our first series may notice that Heather Evans is not beside me this time around. That's because Heather is off on an incredible journey. She is continuing her professional development with a year studying AI, technology, and policy in Beijing at Tsinghua University as one of the recognized Schwarzman Scholars, one of the most prestigious scholarship programs in the world. All of us at Ask AI wish Heather the very best in that adventure, and we hope that we hear all about it in the near future. We'll share some pictures. In the meantime, you can follow Heather on Twitter at @_HeatherE. Good luck with everything, Heather, and be sure to come back to us. So in other community news, we're currently putting the final touches on our next Toronto event, which will be taking place on Thursday, November 8th, 2018 at 6 p.m. The event will take place at Top Hat's headquarters, which is at Bay and Bloor. This will be our second meetup at Top Hat and our third in Toronto in the past 12 months. This time at the event, we'll be exploring the exciting and very Canadian topic of AI in healthcare. We have some amazing presenters and some startups lined up that we're already really, really excited to be working with. And like our previous events, this one will be free to attend and food and beverages will be served. But of course, you'll need to join our meetup group first to grab your seat. You can find that by Googling the Ask AI meetup group. We'll also share a link out with the podcast. To do that, you can also go to askai.org and click on Toronto events from the homepage. By the way, we're looking for event sponsors, and we have some very flexible packages that feed 100% back in the event. There's no profit being made from this. It's all about how do we support the community. And if your company would like to support a more inclusive Canadian AI sector, you can email us at info@askai.org. Okay, let's get it going. So today we're very happy to have Dr. Wendy Sukier in the Ask AI studio with us. Wendy is the founder and academic director of the Ryerson Diversity Institute and the International Innovation and Inclusion Network. She's also a professor of entrepreneurship and strategy at the Ted Rogers School of Management and chair of the board of the Women's College Hospital. Wendy, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
We're also joined today by Mark Patterson, the executive director of Magnet, a not-for-profit digital social innovation platform co-created by Ryerson University in partnership with the Ontario Chamber of Commerce in 2014. Magnet's mission is to accelerate inclusive community growth and economic growth for all in Canada by advancing careers, businesses, and communities. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
Welcome, Dr. Wendy Sukier and Mark Patterson. We're very pleased to have both of you on the show. Mark, let's start off with you, if that's all right.
Great.
So in this podcast, we cover the technology and the ethics of AI. And on balance, the outlooks have been pretty positive. But clearly, AI and other technologies like blockchain and robotics will have a huge impact on the Canadian workplace and job skills. So we're seeing so much about this in the media and everywhere around the world. I know this is at the heart of a lot of the research and the work that you are doing. Could you tell us a bit more about Magnet, Mark, and how are you seeing Canada's skills landscape change?
Yeah, so Magnet is a project that started at Ryerson, as was mentioned, and we really focus on three of the core issues that we think businesses are facing as they grow. So access to talent, access to markets, and access to capital. And so with respect to access to talent and specifically to AI roles and jobs and requirements in the labor market, we've been focused on making sure that we understand where the skills are being developed, helping employers connect to them more quickly, and understanding how we can build career awareness in youth as they're coming up through high school, post-secondary, to understand in a rapidly changing environment what are the emerging opportunities that are available. We think really looking holistically at the system and understanding some of the challenges and barriers and then looking for solutions with government, with post-secondary, with community-based organizations to address those.
Fantastic. And I wonder if you could even highlight, I mean, what are a couple of things that Canada could be doing to make that change. And I mean, some people have even described this as the fourth industrial revolution. I mean, this is a cataclysmic change that's happening in our society.
Yeah, well, I absolutely think we need to be informing youth earlier in their educational pathways about the opportunities that are changing so quickly. We know that most students entering, primary and secondary education now will be looking at opportunities that we're not even thinking of at the current time. So while we need to have all the foundational skills that are so important, math and so on, essential skills that students need to develop, we need to think about the systems that are informing individuals, informing curriculum, informing investment by government to make sure that the labor force is aligned. So I mean, a specific example would be, do youth now really know about the opportunities to become a data scientist and what that means and what it means in an AI context? Does government and education understand, and does even the AI, emerging AI sector understand the variety of jobs? Often when we talk about AI, we think data scientists, but what is the exposure to all of the other roles. So, for example, what about the marketer that needs to understand AI to work in a marketing role in an AI company? What about the salesperson that has to have an understanding of AI as well? So how do we unpack the discussion for the government that it's not only data scientists that are needed, but it's also a lot of these other skills with exposure to the industry? And also, how do we make sure we're being inclusive? So how are we tapping into all of the diverse talent that exists, that are underrepresented in the labor market, students with disabilities, Indigenous youth, and exposing more women into technology roles, math roles. So there's a lot of barriers that are in the system or at a systemic level that we need to look at, and we need a holistic view with the goal of making sure we have as close an alignment of our labor market with the needs of our emerging industries and sectors. And we think it's a solution that it's not about one company, it's not about one initiative, it's how do we all come together in a collaborative way to address this for our collective future, for Canada's prosperity.
I love the points in particular about, how do we broaden this beyond simply training a million more data scientists? I mean, society has so many different components, and as well, we're also discovering that, yes, there's a lot of Canadian startups that we've seen, yes, get funding for being AI companies and working on the technology, but we've often traditionally failed to, scale at the level we need to. And so now we're getting companies that at the scale-up stage are requiring, as you mentioned, that marketing, that sales talent, the commercialization talent, who have that AI or data literacy to also actually then make the company successful. And I also love the points that you made in the context of diversity and in terms of inclusion. I mean, how do we make this so that from a population basis, it doesn't just, benefit the traditional folks who've benefited in the past from these rises in technologies changes. And that's probably a great jumping off point to also hear from Wendy. At Ask AI, we're really committed to focusing on diversity and particularly believing that artificial intelligence as a generational technology should include as many voices as possible, particularly Canadian voices. So maybe, Wendy, I'm wondering if you could describe the work being done at the Ryerson Diversity Institute. What kind of work would that tie into in terms of this conversation?
So thanks for the question. I think we come at this issue from a number of different perspectives. So because part of our raison d'etre is really to drive inclusive innovation, we're really interested in the trajectories of technology adoption, first off. Secondly, we're interested in what the implications are for talent and the workforce. So very much as Mark has already described, the issue from our perspective is not simply making sure that we have, for example, more women in engineering and computer science and data science, all of which are very, very important, but also that we recognize that the real impediments to the potential of AI are actually around adoption. And if we don't have people and organizations prepared to use the technology, we will not achieve the outcomes that everybody is hoping for. And we will not avoid the negative consequences. We will not be able to scale up the AI industry. And we did a survey recently of AI employers and found, for example, that, of course, they're looking for more high-end scientists and researchers that they can pay six figures to. But one of the most acute shortages in the industry is actually product managers, salespeople, project managers, people who can actually understand what the potential of the technology is and work with organizations and consumers. And it's funny, I've been in the industry long enough to remember all of the hype around electronic health records and how it was going to transform health systems more than 30 years ago. The impediments to the transformation of healthcare have not fundamentally been technological. They have been related to regulation, to organizational systems, to reward systems, to human behavior, to privacy issues and security and so on. And I think you can search and replace electronic health records, artificial intelligence, and certainly in the healthcare sector, see many of those issues. Those issues are fundamentally not the domain of computer scientists and engineers. Those issues are very much the domain of people who work in the social sciences and humanities, policymakers, and so on. So I think that in addition to focusing on increasing the inclusion of women in those core disciplines everyone associates with AI, I think we have to rethink the whole innovation process to recognize it's not just about making the technology, because you only get innovation when someone does something with the technology. So what are the barriers to adoption? Who are the people that can help address those issues? And typically, that opens up a whole nother set of talented individuals who are not currently part of the conversation. So that's an important dimension. The other piece, when you look at the innovation question and how you're going to drive inclusive innovation, we know that artificial intelligence and the algorithms that often underlie the decision processes are fundamentally influenced by the people who make them. And there's been lots of research that has flagged the potential risks and implications if we embed biases that exist among developers into the tools themselves. And I think everybody knows some of the most egregious examples of where that's happened. On the other hand, I was at a meeting that was organized by the Department of Finance here and the Ministry of Industrial Development in the UK, talking about some of these fundamental issues. And one of the examples that was raised, which is very akin to what Magnet does, is the potential of the technology to actually reduce the chances of bias in recruitment, hiring, and decision-making processes. Because I was on a panel with a really interesting AI researcher, and she said, you know, when we look at AI, at least we can figure out what the rules are that the algorithms are embedding. When we look at human decision-making about who to cut off welfare or who to put on probation or who to hire, we don't know what rules they're actually embedding in those decisions. And often what humans will tell us are very different from the ways in which they think and act. So there's enormous potential of this technology to be much fairer and more equitable around all kinds of decision processes if we get those basic principles right. And I think that has profound implications for diversity and inclusion in virtually every sector.
I know that we've been raising the issue of bias in AI since the first episode of this podcast. We really want to make sure that we talked about the ethics, that we talked about diversity, because it's one of those uses of technology where, you know, everything is about the actual data that you have, the inputs. If you're just putting garbage or biased data in, you're going to get garbage out. Those recommendations and decisions will also be biased. And so it seems like perhaps the diversity conversation, which I know is so critical and so ubiquitous in tech right now as it should be, is perhaps even more important than ever because AI is so prominent. One question I did want to ask is, I mean, we know that there's this bias problem, but how can really tech companies, especially AI companies, really start to diversify both their product development teams as well as their validation groups, feedback processes, community, you know, assets, and what can really be done? How can we help this along?
Well, I think it's not a cure-all, but certainly increasing the diversity of the teams will perhaps reduce the chances of baking in certain kinds of biases, making sure that AI companies, like other companies, embrace diversity and inclusion at all levels and really think about it through the entire value chain, not just in terms of who they hire, but how they design their products, who they're designing their products for. An interesting point was made to me recently about how we have to differentiate the issues around the data and the issues around the algorithms, and we almost need two separate lenses for looking at those two issues in a very clear and critical way. And you can develop tools and checklists and techniques for testing for bias in exactly the same way that you build in other kinds of quality assurance processes to your software development, if that's a priority. And I think that's the level at which we really have to think about the diversity and inclusion issues. It's way beyond HR. It has to be, of course, baked into your governance structure and who you hire and so on, but it has to be built into your whole product development process, from everything from procurement through to design through marketing and so on. And certainly in the lens that you apply to the quality assurance around your software development, your data management and so on, that's huge. When we think of some of the real hot button issues in this space right now, privacy, security issues, and so on, we also have to recognize that all people are not created equal in terms of their access to information, understanding, tools, and techniques. So that's another thing that we have to think about. If you look at some of the services that are AI-enabled that are being rolled out, and you think about vulnerable populations, whether it's people with limited literacy, whether it's people with limited access to technology and knowledge of technology, whether it's aging people with diminishing cognitive ability, we have to really think about those issues very, very carefully when we're designing safeguards and interfaces. Because I think that the industry is starting to recognize that trust is going to be absolutely fundamental to the success of the adoption of AI-enabled tools. And one of the best ways to develop trust with consumers and with government agencies and so on is to not treat the issues of privacy and security as something that's being imposed on you by someone outside, but understanding that those are really fundamental values that you have to embrace.
Fantastic. And Mark, I wanted to ask you on sort of the flip side of this. I mean, you're working with a number of different partners across the public sector, the private sector, the social sector to, as we discussed, grow our talent and our workforce to be able to start working on these problems. And I'm wondering, perhaps from the curriculum, from the education side, do you see opportunities or potential for all of these topics to start being incorporated in a broader set of lenses? So not just the technical development, but that being positioned alongside this almost this literacy, this ethical set of conversations at the same time. Do you see that, or do you see conversations around that happening?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'd actually just like to pick up quickly on make another further point on what Wendy touched on. But as an example, if you're building a platform or you're building your technology out, you know that it's going to cost you a lot more time, effort, and resources if you want to internationalize it, you know, 2 years into your development, right? Or if you want to all of a sudden understand that you have to be AODA compliant, right? Yeah. If you do those things later, that's a tremendous, huge cost. It has to be embedded. AODA compliance, as an example of building your site, has to be built in at the beginning. I would say and make the case that diversity inclusion as well has to be, because you're reflecting your product is being built for a diverse audience, and it needs to be built in, as Wendy has already gone through. But I think that's a really important point. You compare it to some of the other things that you know as a developer that it's going to cost you a lot more after. I would say diversity and inclusion has to have, if not the same, even a higher level of focus early on with AI. So
my question, I suppose, is, yeah, I mean, how can we make sure that people get trained in those competencies at the same time as they're learning these other technical development skills?
Yeah, well, I think part of it, so I'd step back. We've focused on a lot of, so with any labor shortage, you start looking outside into groups or individuals that may not see or even think of AI in their career path. So where would a student that has some of these skills, for example, Wendy's mentioned in the social science humanities, that might not be in the recruitment path of an AI company, but they have the aptitude to work in this field. So, and they've had the training in some of these issues and human design and so on. So I think for us, it's trying to remove the blinders on behalf of young people coming up and developing skills to be productive members in the labor market. And it's also important for companies to recognize that you don't only have to recruit out of the traditional suspect program. So for us, it's how do you broaden, deepen that pool? I'll give you one specific example. We know and have worked with an organization called Specialist Turner, and they work with people with neurocognitive issues or on the autism spectrum. And they actually focused on hiring people into anti-money laundering roles in the major financial institutions. And Specialist Turner's group that worked on, so CIBC basically gave them the authority to hire the people, and CIBC would just focus on kind of their due diligence in making sure to hire. They hired, last time I checked in on the project, they had hired about 9 to 12 people, and those people were finding things in the data that the algorithms and so on weren't even touching. And so there's this idea, it's not an idea, it's a fact, but that, you know, we need to, you know, it's about finding the right fit, where oftentimes, for example, something we classify as a disability actually becomes an ability. And really focusing on breaking down those barriers, non-traditional pathways to meeting some of these skills challenges, I think, is really important in the current context to build an inclusive society and inclusive economic development. And it will have benefits in, you know, adoption and all of the other things we've talked about. I think it's important to recognize as well, and we could talk about this further, but you know, there's two sides to being diverse and inclusive. You also have to focus on building the capacity to manage diversity in your team. So there needs to be attention on, you know, leadership in some of these emerging companies and startups, whether they're supported in an incubator like 111 or the Digital Media Zone. But these are some of the most important things that we see. Hiring the right team, finding the right fit, being are as, if not more important than what we like to focus on when we're doing a startup, being raising capital. You know, some of these HR and other issues are even more important. So we just see a huge fit and opportunity if we can work with companies and break down some of these barriers to be more inclusive and to make more connections and expand the available pool of talent.
I love that series of points, Mark. Particularly, you know, tied to those topics, I've got a younger brother who's on the autism spectrum, who's studying computer science. And he's, you know, he's a brilliant programmer and simply needs, I think, a different mode of engagement sometimes to really be able to provide the immense value that he can. And so constantly thinking about that, I think, in my personal context as well, been through a number of small startups in the past few years and have seen, well, what is working within our team? What is actually enabling different sets of skills, different perspectives to come to the forefront, create products, create a culture, and then build that up and share it out with the world. it is such a different composite that I really see that comes together. I've been lucky, I think, enough to, yes, you know, work at a 111, a great space here that is really bringing a community together to surround ourselves in those best practices and really share them with each other. And, you know, working with great founders like my own who do really imbue us with that sense that we all have something to contribute and can do that and recruit broadly from a number of different areas and skill sets. So we're trying to build up those, I think, best practices, best examples, and start to show it. And I'm glad that we've got so many different vehicles to help push that along. Switching gears a bit from that topic, I did want to ask you, Dr. Suke, if there is anything that is interesting or concerning you when it comes to the adoption of AI in, I know, your other specialty with in terms of your work in the Women's College Hospital, but that's in Canada's healthcare and mental health research and practices. How is AI being used there? What are some of the early applications that you might be seeing?
You know, I think AI has amazing potential in healthcare, from starting with population health analysis, helping us do a better job of identifying causal factors and how to deal with specific populations and develop appropriate treatments through care support. You know, we've seen some early evidence of decision-making support systems that can help improve diagnostic processes. We've seen applications around image recognition and radiology in particular. It's funny when people talk about occupations that may be threatened potentially by AI or reduced by AI. Some of them are actually high-end healthcare specializations where there's early evidence that machines can do things more efficiently than people can. Certainly when we think about process design, when we think about, you know, the very intensive data management, patient support, health records systems that underpin everything we're doing in healthcare, through the entire value chain in healthcare, the potential is quite remarkable, and some of the trials and the startups, very, very exciting. But I go back to what I said earlier. I've been working in health tech since before you were born. And I can show you quotes saying, you know, electronic health records will transform the health sector in the next few years once we work out some of the logistic problems. It's from wild. 1990.
Yeah.
From 1990. And yet in many places in Toronto, it's still easier to make a restaurant reservation than to book an appointment with our physician. And if you just unpack all of the issues we faced with electronic health records, standards, privacy, behavior, you know, 70% of doctors in a survey that was done by Deloitte in the U.S. didn't think patients should have access to their healthcare records. That's kind of fundamental. So the policies, the organizational structures, the investments we have in legacy systems, et cetera, et cetera. And so for me, the issue with AI and healthcare is massive potential, significant risk, and the need for an integrated strategy that takes into account all of those complex systems, human factors, behavioral issues that we have seen time and time again are often barriers to adoption. The other thing that I'm really interested in, Malcolm Frank, who's one of the VPs at Cognizant, said data is better than oil in his most recent book on artificial intelligence.
That's a fantastic quote.
Well, it's a fantastic quote in that if you think about what that analogy actually leads us to, if you think about oil and the oil-based economy, I mean, data is a renewable resource, which is different than oil, but you can argue that you've got the same kind of complex interactions where it can be used for good, mm-hmm. or it can have terrible unintended consequences if we don't think very carefully about the externalities. I mean, not only do we have all of the environmental damage that oil potentially wreaks, but I can advance an argument that most world conflicts and millions of people have died because of wars that were really fundamentally about fighting for oil. So if you start to think about that, you know, in days like today, I wish I were an economist, but if you actually think through what that analogy would lead us to, it would lead us to thinking much more systematically about what the impact of some of these shifts and changes potentially could be. And also, it would push us towards much more long-term and integrated strategies which bring together different stakeholders. Instead of thinking of this as being about, you know, whether or not a handful of startups are going to become unicorns and drive economic development, it would lead us to thinking about a real fundamental shift in our economy and in society. And that would lead us, I think, to much more intelligence, policy, and decision-making on a very, very high level. So healthcare, I think, is amazing in terms of its the ways in which AI could make us do a much better job, reach more people, provide more access, improve quality and services. But I really worry that we will not achieve that potential because we will make the same mistakes that we have made over and over and over in the past in focusing on the technical bits instead of those bigger systems that AI is embedded in.
And all the connective tissue that I think combines and puts these systems together. I think there's so many incredible points in what you just said. I mean, particularly, you know, wanted to comment on the misuse of data that we're already seeing. I mean, look at, you talked about conflict. I mean, the hyper-targeting of communities as far as, you know, in Myanmar and spurring on additional conflict against the Rohingya, you know, for example, and not to mention, of course, the 2016 election and everything else going on in Eastern Europe. And I mean, all these different ways in which data and hyper-targeting of specific communities to incite conflict is already happening. Not to mention, you know, multi-stage corporate espionage and everything else going on. I mean, we certainly see that. And I think even more concerning is, you know, yes, if your healthcare data is perhaps simply out there in the wild, what does that actually entail? There's so many things to think about. That being said, I mean, there are a lot of bright spots. I would love to call out to, you know, a few interesting Canadian startups who are working on problems like this. But, you know, companies like Dot Health, founded by one of our top entrepreneurs in the country, Huda Idris. She previously was the chief product officer at Wealthsimple, but they are absolutely working on that digital health records problem. And I think, you know, they're making a decent crack at it. But interestingly enough, she was actually speaking on Twitter today and pulled in a number of other health entrepreneurs in the country, but about simply the fact that a lot of the healthcare conferences and systems being discussed right now simply aren't happening in a productive way. And as you mentioned, I mean, the complexity is just gone. And so if none of that is actually happening in a platform that is useful, how are these new entrepreneurs actually going to become able to do anything if the basics are not even there for them to even convene upon?
Well, it's a huge problem. And one of the things that I've been calling on people who are on, for example, boards of healthcare organizations, policymakers, and so on, is to start to demand that we really think about what the implications of AI are in healthcare in a very practical way. It's enormously important, as I said, because the potential of the technology is massive. And it isn't just in the context of organized health care as we think of it in hospitals or, you know, we often focus on clinical applications and so on. It's also in the domain of self-care, in the ways in which we can extend ambulatory care so that people don't have to be in hospitals. They can be better cared for at home. If we think about preventative mechanisms, if we think about, both diagnostic and nudge tools to help people with everything from addictions to mental health issues to cognitive cognitive differences and so on. Like the potential of this technology to advance our society is so massive, but it's almost as if the risks are equally massive. And I don't feel that we have, a strategic approach. I think we have a lot of people working in silos, very preoccupied with a particular project or company that they are focused on advancing their particular product or company or application or university program without any reference to other people. And we know that, in my view anyways, we have to take an ecosystem approach. We have to think about where the levers are that will drive change. We have to think about the processes that will drive adoption, and we have to think about what the barriers and impediments are to achieving those goals. And I don't know, you travel in these circles more than I do, but I hear very, very few people talking about how all those pieces fit together.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned Nudge Tools. Working at an AI company called Nudge, I can't help but feel drastically optimistic about this entire scenario. But I think you're right. I mean, running around in these circles, I think sometimes, and I don't blame startup founders who are often strapped for cash and simply trying to put things together with, you know, cutting-edge technologies that are literally coming out by the day, competing for talent against internet giants across multiple countries, trying to assemble these teams of researchers who, you know, are actually more limited, and there's such a fight for all of these different resources, it can't help but feel scarce sometimes. And I think sometimes people don't think from a systemic approach when their mindset is one of scarcity, even when they're trying to grow something. So I think, you know, we have an opportunity and a challenge here in this community in between, you know, whatever it is, the technology and the policy circles and everything in between. It's, well, how do we at least convene the conversation and make sure that we have some toolkits, playbooks, whatever it is available so that people can start off on the right foot. And as Mark mentioned, there's a lot of opportunities where you can actually start on the right foot. And if you do so, it will actually help you when you do reach a point of scale so that you don't have to backtrack. It will save us all time and money and make sure we're actually building for something. I did want to bring it back because I know we're reaching the time of our episodes. Mark, to you one last time, which would be, Dr. Suke was talking a lot about, you know, this ecosystem approach that we need to take. And I know a lot of what you are doing is building a platform to bring together different points of the ecosystem, and perhaps trying to bridge two different things, which would be our big conversation about healthcare and what does that scope look like, but also talent. I mean, maybe I speak in this as a millennial, but we are in this crazy situation where we have a rapidly aging population. We're all trying to navigate these dramatic workplace shifts. But I'm wondering, like, what are the conversations happening like that in the context of Magnet to have this ecosystem, to have this platform available and ready for people to navigate this environment?
Yeah, well, a great question. I mean, there's been a lot of discussion around the need for real-time labor market information to help people make more informed decisions about their career. The government's been working on that. I sit on a national stakeholder advisory for the Labor Market Information Council. So it's not a lack of data that's out there, but there is not a great way of providing that data in a context that an individual can make a decision. So the path the government has been on is building this big website where I think they think students are going to sit down and Google labor market information and then try and figure out their career. What we're really trying to do is how do we contextualize it and get it embedded into the systems that they're using every day so they can make quick decisions about their career. We can inform people that, hey, you know, these are the skills you have now through your experience or through your education, and this is a gap if you wanted to do this. Hey, did you know this is a potential pathway for you? And on the opposite side, help employers understand that they don't have to only look in the traditional pools. So we see a lot of the issue with employers connecting to talent being simply, like I said earlier, some of the actual systemic barriers in the system. So, you know, most companies, yes, you'll go to Waterloo and Post, you know, if you want to find your data scientists, maybe a few other schools. But we have, you know, almost 200 institutions in the country that are all producing great talent. Sometimes the talent's in programs. You know, I know a guy we hired, a developer on our team, who was a periodontist. Got tired of being a periodontist. right? He knows how to develop. Do we care that he didn't take computer science? He's a great developer. So how do we surface competencies and skills in a way that's more accessible? And how do we break down all the silos? So I'll give you an example. You know, if Nudge was trying to hire right now and you want to hire at a post-secondary, you literally have to have someone in your team create a posting on every single school job board across the country. There's no place you can go and place one posting and get that posting up on every school in Canada. So that's a problem we've actually fixed. We're launching very soon, where you'll be able to go get industry information about how to connect to talent quickly. And that's just the posting distribution. But where we really want to take it to is competencies and skills. So so where we really want to take it to is competencies and skills. Instead of employers posting thinking, hey, I should go to this program at this school, they can say, I want this combination of skills and experiences and maybe requirements or credentials, but not have to know every program at every school in Canada where talent is being produced. We also think, again, surfacing people in non-traditional pools through other means. So we're doing some assessment-based matching, finding people that have the aptitudes, personality attributes, behaviors, emotional competencies to be a fit, for example, in a entry-level role in the AI sector, and then helping fill the gap. And Wendy has a program that she's had for a number of years, taking students in social science humanities and transitioning them into tech light roles. So really, really looking at different ways to make the connections, maximize the use of our talent pool in Canada, make sure we're keeping communities and individuals that have barriers potentially to employment, making sure we're not leaving anybody behind, and really looking at focusing on inclusive economic development. If we can do that, I think everybody wins. So there are some ways that we can really drastically improve or reduce the fragmentation in the system, in what I call the publicly funded employment service system, which we all as Canadians spend billions of dollars a year on. There's ways we can reduce that fragmentation, make it easier for employers to find the talent they need, and make sure people are being included in the labor market and being productive members of society as all people want to do.
So many different topics today and so many different layers. I feel like we could have gone all night long. We're going to have you guys back on again. Thank you so much both for speaking with us today. I know there might be a couple last comments. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners? Perhaps Dr. Suki, you can start.
Try to be brief, but there's sort of two quick anecdotes that I'd really like to share, because I think they show part of the power of what Magnet and Mark are trying to do. And that is, it isn't just about fixing the talent and making sure that they have the right skills. It's also about getting employers to think in different ways about talent, focus on competencies. Because the tendency is always to hire in your own image. So if I went to this university, I want someone from the same university because I'm awesome and they will be too. And we had a case where a large firm came to us and said they wanted a course in Pega, which is a software application, AI-enabled, introduced into curriculum at the university, and they wanted to meet the dean of computer science and engineering. And I said, okay, I'll do that. But just remember, professors don't like to learn anything new. It's proprietary software. And even if they agree to introduce it, it'll take a couple of years, and it'll be a few years before anyone comes out the other end, and then the world will have changed. How long does it take someone to learn this? Oh, well, you know, it's a year-long course. I said, no. If we just took someone who had the right aptitude and taught them the stuff they needed to know, could you do it in 4 weeks? Maybe. So I said, okay, well, let's try an experiment. We'll introduce you to the formal academic decision makers, and you can work that path. But we have a lot of immigrants in Canada who are driving taxis and working as security guards, who have degrees in computer science.
Or PhDs in molecular engineering, for God's sake. Sometimes it's unbelievable when you ask a taxi driver in particular where they're coming from in their education background.
So beginning of June, we had the conversation. Middle of June, they agreed. End of June, we went out to our immigrant partner organizations. We had 88 applicants. We let them pick who they would actually employ, because I'm not training anybody for any jobs that are theoretical. I wanted the jobs on the table. And they picked something like 16. More than half of them were women. We ran the program in July. By the end of August, all of them were certified. Some had to do it twice. Wow. And last I heard, 14 out of the 16 had job offers, and the two that didn't had gone back to school. So that was an example of employers looking here, and the talent was over here. Another example is I have a daughter who has a master's degree in fine arts. And she was okay in math, and I keep every once in a while forcing her to do things she doesn't necessarily want to do. She did a bit maker course in data science, one of those intensive things that we organized through ADAPT as a short-term program. And she was in with people who had PhDs and MBAs and much stronger math backgrounds. She toughed it out. And after 6 days of the intensive program, was one of the top picks of the employers that were recruiting at the event, right? This is a kid with, you know, philosophy and English and fine art as her background, but clearly an aptitude. And they were using Tableau and various things which resonated with her visualization capability and so on. So to me, that was a perfect example of somebody who would not at all be one of the usual suspects or the typical recruits that any of these software and financial services companies would be looking at under normal circumstances. But you throw her in the deep end, she can do the work. Why wouldn't she have the same opportunity to get a job as someone who had done a different pathway? And I think that's the beauty of what Magnet is potentially offering. That's one of the benefits of AI-enabled tools that are used for good rather than for ill, is increasing the level of objectivity and fairness into the systems that we use to identify talent, to train them, to assess them, and to transition them into the workforce. What we really need to do that is employers who are a little more open-minded in terms of thinking about who they want and where they're going to get them.
I think it's incredible that the demand we're seeing for talent can so often be filled, not just by the, you know, more and more STEM grads, but also with people with diverse, often liberal arts backgrounds. We've seen the resurgence of the importance of people with diverse backgrounds in the humanities, so on and so forth. And I think, as you mentioned, I mean, these connective programs can often be the key facilitation mechanism, programs like Magnet, to match this seemingly self-imposed blindness that employers, institutions may have towards accepting a broader array of candidates. That could help us solve our war for talent, so to speak. Simply by using the homegrown resources and people available around us. It's amazing. Thank you so much both for joining us today on the Ask AI podcast. To our listeners, please remember that you can get links to everything we've chatted about in this episode on the Ask AI blog. You can also stream this interview and connect with hundreds of people, companies, and resources in the Canadian AI sector in our chatbot. Finally, a quick reminder that Ask AI is 100% volunteer run. So if you like what you hear, please follow, like, or rate our show in iTunes, Google Play, or Spotify. Please throw 5 stars. I'd really appreciate it. It makes a huge difference in helping more people to hear the show. Until next time, this has been Jackson Kahn, your host for the Ask AI podcast. Thank you so much to Dr. Sukier and Mr. Mark Patterson.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode's senior producer was Mike Letourneau, and executive producer was Chris McClellan. For more information, please visit our website at askai.org.